have something exciting to tell you this week. When I started Motherkind, I wrote a list of brands that I dreamed of working with, and this brand was right at the top. Stöcker has been one of my most loved brands since I became a mum 8 years ago, and to have them as the show's headline sponsor for a whole year feels like a dream come true. The first product I bought 8 years ago was the famous Trip Trap chair, which my eldest still uses today. And what I love so much about Stöcker is that they are the antithesis to so much of the low quality plastic products out there. Their products really do grow with your children, and I think the quality of them is just unrivaled. The chair is designed to bring your little one to the table from day one, and we all know how important that time is to eat and chat together, especially as we know how crucial those early experiences are. And excitingly, a few years ago, Stöcker acquired Baby Zen, the amazing buggy brand famous for the foldable yo-yo, which also happens to be my absolute favourite buggy. And there is so much more I want to tell you about this incredible brand and their products. Luckily, I've got all year. So in the meantime, have a look at stöcker.com. That's stöcker.com. Welcome to Motherkind with me, your host, Zoe Blasky, sponsored by Stöcker. This is the show that's going to help you feel more confident, connected and empowered in motherhood. I cannot wait to share this week's episode with you. It is with Paul Brunson. Paul is an internationally recognised relationship expert. He's an entrepreneur and a TV host. He is the co-host of Celeb Goes Dating, or you might have seen him on my favourite show, Married at First Sight UK. And he has a new book out called Find Love. This is one of those must listen episodes. Paul teaches us why we have to prioritize our partner over our children. Yes, he did go viral, and not in a good way, for saying that on Lorraine. So we really unpack that. How to know whether your relationship is the right one, when you know the time is right to leave, and why actually divorce can be the best thing for our children. I adore Paul. He is smart. He's unbelievably knowledgeable. And I know you are going to love this insight-packed episode. Before we get to the episode, can you do me a favor? You would have discovered this podcast because someone shared it with you. We don't spend a penny advertising it. So can you pay that forward? Can you share on social media? Can you tell a mum at the nursery or school gates about it? Can you pop it in a WhatsApp group and help me spread these empowering, expert-led conversations? We need way more of this in motherhood. So help me be part of that mission. Here it is. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you.
I'm so happy to be sat here with you.
This is really cool. I already know we're going to talk for 5 hours.
Yeah. Someone better stop us, seriously. I know. Well, something is on my mind that I want to ask you about straight up.
Let's do it.
I was looking at some research last week.
Yes.
As I do, because you and me are both complete research nerds.
We're nerds, yes.
And it was saying that marital satisfaction significantly declines.
Yes.
First 6 years.
Okay.
Of parenthood.
Okay.
Especially for the woman.
Okay.
Why do you think that is?
Can I ask, on the nerdy side, can I ask whose research was it?
It was Gottman.
Okay. So here's the reason why I asked that question.
Yeah.
And this is not, I mean, I'm a disciple, right, of John Gottman. A lot of research is biased. A lot of it is. To the point where I would say most of it is. And that's why I think it's always important to look at the research, look at who is funding the research, and then look at the politics of the funder. And then you'll see that there's either a very hard conservative tilt or there's a hard liberal tilt, but rarely do you get it right down the center.
Yeah.
And that's why you want to have a little bit of it all. But for Gottman, all right, I get it. So I suppose, because I haven't read the study, but I suppose there's several reasons. One is that generally now marital satisfaction is on the decline anyway. So Eli Finkel research, and he wrote this in his book, All or Nothing Marriage, which I recommend to everyone. I think it's a brilliant book, is he talks about how now 80% of modern day marriages have less satisfaction than ever before. And you think about that, you're like, oh my God, then ever before? Like, my grandparents weren't even happy. So
we are screwed.
We are all going to hell. Right? It's like, it's terrible. But then you all, the upside is that, well, 20% is more happy than ever before. And when he breaks down the reasons behind it, he looks at all of the tools and assessments and all of the interventions that we have today that some couples use and other couples don't, right? So that could be one reason of what's happening. But I suspect there's a deeper reason, and this one could get me into trouble, but I will say it, is that from my personal experience, most, not even some, I will say most, heterosexual women who enter marriage have been chosen and they haven't made the selection themselves. They've been chosen by a partner. So they have entered the dating market. They have met their partner wherever. It could be on a dating app. It could be a friend or whatever it may be. Their partner has shown high interest in them. And all studies show that in heterosexual relationships, men pursue at a much faster rate. Men are first to say, I love you. Men are first to kind of lock down their partner. And there's evolutionary reasons for that. And as a result, it's typically the man who's saying, okay, you're going to be my partner. Like, think about even how, you know, and this is very patriarchal, but how the system is set up. It's like, of course the man is going to propose. Like,
yeah, and he has to go and ask your father. I mean, could it be more patriarchal?
Yeah, it's all ridiculous, yeah. Right? So I suspect that's also that's also a reason. And then I would say a third reason, if I'm just saying for three, is that we, and I think this is a good thing, is that marriage is becoming easier to exit. So I'm a massive advocate for marriage and committed partnership, but I think marriage should be much harder to enter, but easy to exit. And so we now in the UK, you know, no-fault divorce is rolled out, which is good. It'll still take you months and lots of money to get out. But as a result of more people separating, there's this whole research around there being a contagiousness to separation,
yep.
Right? Where if you have a friend who's separated, you have, or who's divorced, you have a 75% more likelihood of being divorced if your friend, your close friend, is divorced. So I think what's happening is to a lot of ladies now being more empowered in their relationship, they see their friends leaving, etc., and they say, "Oh, you know what? I could leave too," or begin to reevaluate their relationship and realize, okay, I'm not as satisfied as I could be. So I suspect there's multiple reasons. Those would be three that I would throw out as possible contributors.
What do you think it is about having kids? Because the study was that it's the first 6 years of parenthood.
I've just started sleeping full nights, you know, and my youngest is nine. You know, it's one of those where it is.
But this is where we need your help, Paul, because it is this pressure pot. So, you know, we know, I know I've read so many studies. It's in your book, like how important like modeling a healthy partnership is for kids. And yet there's never been a time when I've been more tired. I've been more resentful. I've been more, you know, everything changes. And I just don't think we're given the skills. I certainly didn't have the skills to navigate that.
True. But you know what? As we're talking, I thought of a reason that is stronger than the three previous that I gave.
Go right? ahead.
So one of the top reasons that people identify that they have dissatisfaction in their relationship, this is all folks, is equity in their relationship. And when I think about, you know, some of my friends, I'm not going to dime you all out, but some of my fellas, they're like, I've never changed a, here it's a nappy, right?
Yeah.
Ours is diapers.
Yeah.
Never changed a nappy before, you know, because I'm the breadwinner when, you know, when the baby can't go to sleep, I go to sleep, she stays up, right? You know, this is the equity in the relationship is not there, and that sparks that dissatisfaction on the part of the person who overwhelmingly is carrying the burden, you know, and connecting it to stress. And you know, women have been the stress sponges,
yeah,
like of humanity. And we have 100%. To just, we just have to accept that. And even if you look at the modern day relationships, we have to realize it's just since the late 1960s, only in certain parts of the world where women have finally had a little bit of say in the relationship. So think about that. For hundreds of thousands of years, it has been one system. Men determine, you know, the entity, the dating entity. They determine the institution. They determine what's going to happen in the institution. And this is still happening in the vast majority of the world. So yeah, we're at a place where it's really screwy. But the silver lining here is that we're beginning to get glimmers of hope and change.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think that's absolutely what that research would be speaking to, is that equity point. Because we've got more mothers working than ever before.
Yes.
But if the systems don't change in the home, it's just unbelievable the amount of work that is to do paid work. And then the significant amount, you know, I think the UN recently came out and said women are doing 75% of the unpaid labor in the home.
Of the unpaid labor. See, there you go. I mean, it's not there. The equity is not there. And I think we kind of consciously know this, right? That the equity is not there in most homes. It's like, I even think about, you know, I think about my family, and I go home, you know, my mother, for example, my parents are retired, right? But my mother still she'll wake up, she will cook all the meals, you know, she will then clean up afterwards. She will, like, you know, she is doing 75% of the work in the house. But now also, you know what's interesting about it is that she sees that as her, how she is delivering love. Because you can't even wrestle it away from her. You're like, no, Ma, I can take it. She's like, no.
So she's tying her worth to it.
Yes.
Did you and Jill, before you had kids or a few years in, have to sit down and recalibrate this kind of domestic equity at home? Or did you guys nail it from day one?
No, I mean,
thank God.
I wish I could say, yeah, we got it. No, we're still on it. Like last night, I was like, Jill, I'm going to sleep. She said, not until you take out the trash or you know, the rubbish here. But so we're still working on it. But there were several things that we did. But I'll say the biggest thing, quite honestly, is we had premarital counseling. Game changer. Because with premarital counseling, we were forced to talk about lots of topics that we didn't delve into, like finance. Like how are we going to, are we going to have a separate bank account? Are we going to have a shared bank account? So premarital counseling was very, very instrumental for us.
You know, I had the same. We talked about this last time.
See, it's a win.
Someone so wise said to me, what's the number one thing you're looking for in a partner? Because I was going out with Guy, I think he had proposed, I'd said yes, but I was like, you know, it's a massive decision in your book, biggest decision you'll ever make.
Yes.
So I said, she said, what's the number one thing you're looking for in a partner? I said, someone who's willing to grow with me.
Okay, that's big.
And she said, what you could do is ask if he'll be up for premarital counseling. If he says no, fixed mindset, run a mile.
There you go.
If he says yes, and so I said to him, nervous as hell, because his answer would determine, right?
Yes.
What I said about this. I said, I reckon we should go. Neither of us have got amazing models of what we want this marriage to be. And he said, that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
And I knew in that moment, I was like, this is the right person.
That was such prolific advice.
Yeah.
That you got. And I think that...
I never would have thought of it.
No. And it applies to in the marriage or in the partnership as well, because you often see, you know, you come into an issue and you have one partner that says, let's just not talk about it, or no, let's not go to therapy, let's not. And when you see this unwillingness to grow, or even how I guess I kind of liken it in the book is this unwillingness to be curious about your partner, about your relationship, that's a red flag.
Yeah, because you're stuck, right?
I mean,
what do you do if you've got a partner who can't self-reflect at all?
Yeah, there's no effort equals interest. I'm married to that. Effort equals interest. And when you have a partner who is unwilling to exert any effort towards not just the relationship, but you have partners not willing to exert any effort towards themselves, that is very much Carol DeWitt closed mindset.
Yeah.
And yeah, at that point, you unfortunately have to decide if that's acceptable to you, because that's the best you'll get.
Yeah, God, it's, and I think there'll be a lot of people listening who sadly are in that place. It's common, right?
It's common. It's common. And this is where your personal satisfaction, well-being, self-esteem is incredibly important. Because what I have noticed is that those who have higher, whatever you, and you can put it all in one batch, right? In the book, I talk about well-being. When you have high well-being, you tend to not tolerate mediocrity. You know, when you have lower well-being, you accept that. So this is the reason why it's important to continue to work on our well-being, because our well-being not only helps us to better decide if the partner is right, you know, if I am willing to stay, but typically when you have high well-being, you don't tolerate nonsense.
This is where I think, and I've seen this with so many of my friends, they get into a marriage or a long-term partnership, they have kids, then they start working on their well-being, as you call it. They go to therapy, they mm-hmm. start to set boundaries, they start to have some more worth, some more esteem, and then it doesn't fit anymore.
Yeah.
And that's how you outgrow a marriage, right?
It is. And that's why it's so important to do the work first. That's what the work is. I say the best time to work on your marriage is before you're married. And this is why it's critically important. And it goes back to even what we were talking about in the beginning, is being chosen, right? If you have given no serious consideration to your partner other than, yeah, I like how they look, we have great sex, and we kind of have this alignment and vision. If that is it, which typically is it, it's typically it, then you are not providing any, what I would call diligence, any real consideration in who your partner is. And I fully believe that who you choose as your partner is the most important decision of your life. And so you've got to use rigor. You have to use criteria to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if someone's in that situation where, you know, it felt fine a decade ago, but now it doesn't feel okay. They've got someone who's not willing to grow with them, and they've got two kids together, because I think the 80s, 70s, 80s message that our generations were sold was mm-hmm. that you have to stay for the kids.
Yes. Yes.
Do you?
Yeah. No, you don't. You don't. You definitely don't. And I would say that that is a massive change I've made in my thought. When I was married, when I got married, my mother told me, when you get married, it's for life. And it's, that's it. You make it work. That was the philosophy that I had going into it. And I've come to realize that I love my mother, but she's incorrect in that. And there are many reasons why, but I'll give one major one for someone who has kids, is that our kids are incredibly smart. They're brilliant, and they see all the things we think they don't see. And they are learning from us every second. Every second that we are present, they are learning from us. And what you often find is, you often say, have a couple, right, who don't like each other and are fairly toxic with each other in private, but in front of the kids, we don't cover it. We don't talk about those things. And they think, oh, the kids, they don't know about that. No, the kids know. And they're beginning to model how ineffective you are with your communication, how non-emotive you are, how the fact that you can't resolve conflict. They're modeling all of these things themselves. They're learning these behaviors. And then, because they know you're not getting along with your partner, they begin to think, well, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm the reason why this is happening. And then when your child begins to develop an anxious or avoidant attachment, when they begin to drop their self-esteem, you know why they did that? Because you and your partner chose to stay together. That's why they did it. And so it's very important to say, if you have a partner who's not holding their own, to have conversations around what are we going to do to be better for each other? What are we going to do to do better for our relationship? What are we going to do better for our children? And if the partner is unwilling to do it, then I think that is a partner that doesn't deserve you. They just don't.
So we need to change, we need to completely change that narrative that you leave for the kids.
Yeah, you leave for the kids, because that then teaches them about well-being and prioritizing their well-being and prioritizing their self-esteem. Also, it teaches them about resilience. You know, you think about the characteristics. There was who wrote Grit? Remember the book Grit?
Yeah. Don't know.
And it was like these characteristics that children need to survive in modern world. Resilience, right? Emotional stability. These are all, and our children learn that from us, from their parents, and they're modeling the behavior, you know? So absolutely, we leave for our kids.
God, it's so powerful. It's hard as well, right? Because we need to deprogram ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
Just like your mom said to you, you know, we've all been told that. No, you make it work for the kids.
Yes. And not only have we been told that from, you know, society, but one part, and this is very controversial, and I don't want to get in trouble, but I'm just going to say it, is government. Government does not want you to be divorced. Government does not want you to not have children. Government does not want you to be polyamorous, right? Government wants nice, neat, monogamous, multi, you know, 2.5 children, right? Coupling forever. That's what a government wants. And I'm not specifically saying UK government. I'm saying government around the world. That's what government wants. And if you really analyze, why would divorce be so hard? Why should it be so hard? If you're in a relationship and you are being physically and mentally abused, you still could be trapped in that relationship.
100%.
Why would a society do that to you? Well, because there's incentives for the government for you to be in that relationship, right? Why? There's lots of reasons, but stability is a big one, you know, in terms of an economy. And so if you look at a lot of governments around the world that are facing these dire fertility issues, Japan, South Korea, all over the world with the, I mean, UK also. But if you look, they're starting to offer all types of incentives, and government intrusion has increased in these countries. You know, I just saw in Japan, in Tokyo, they've rolled out matchmaking. The government has rolled out matchmaking. I'm a member of the Global Love Institute, used to be the Professional Matchmakers Association out of New York. The association has been hired by the government of Singapore, the government, to come in and matchmake. And they're trying, so government, the intrusion of government. So when you think about like why we do certain things, we have to understand that society is applying that pressure.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. And therapy is a space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down. Therapy is just an incredible, safe, non-judgmental space. I absolutely love it. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which I think as busy mums is what we all need. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/motherkind today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/motherkind. I think it's so important to name that, because then we, you know, when we're feeling that guilt or we're stuck and we're thinking, why am I even grappling with this question? I'm not happy. I just want to leave. Mm-hmm. It's so self-compassionate.
Yes.
To have that, okay, it's because I've been told my whole life that I've got to fight for this thing. I've been told I'm going to damage my kids
yes.
if I leave. And I think religion has also had a massive part massive, to play in that.
Massive.
But actually, well, I now know I've got to choose myself to choose them.
Yes. Yes. Now, you know, talking about religion, I wrote about this in the book is, this might be what I want to do a deeper investigation to next. This is what I have become obsessed with, is this notion that it was the Western church mm-hmm. that technically created the nuclear family. So this whole thing that we're talking about now came out of the Western church, according to my research, right? And I pull a lot of my research from Dr. Joseph Henrich out of Harvard, who wrote one of my favorite books, The Weirdest People, where he talks about, you know, Western, industrialized, rich, and, you know, democratic. But according to a lot of his research, the research of others, it was the Western church. And what would happen is you have, you know, roughly 1,000, you have the schism, you have Eastern church divides. Western church looks at all of modern day Europe, right? The UK, France, Germany, and we weren't carved out like that, but that's where it was. And how were people living here in the UK during that time? Literally in big clans.
Yeah, it was about 50 people, and then we'd break off and make another.
Exactly. And you would run around in these big clans, and there was one leader of the clan, and who was that? The eldest male, right? Typically, right? And the church, who had broken from the Eastern church, is trying to figure out, well, we need members. We need members. And how are we going to get these members, right? They're... So they introduced what was called the marriage and family plan. And the marriage and family plan systematically introduced different rules and regulations that some say intentionally, others say unintentionally, created the nuclear family and townships. So, for example, one rule was, guess what? No more marrying cousins. They started with the sixth cousin and the fifth cousin and the fourth and the third and the second and the first cousin. And you think, well, does that make a big impact? No more cousin marriages? Well, if you live your entire life in a clan of family members.
Oh, yeah, you got to spread out more.
You are now forced to leave the clan.
Yeah.
And when you leave the clan and you leave the clan and you leave the clan, what happens? The clans become dismantled. And when you are now separate, who can now become the head? Well, the church can become the head. No longer that. They also introduced no more rights to bastard children, right? So you're a male. You're having sex with everybody. Let's keep it 100. Like, that's what was happening, right? Still is what's happening. And now, if you have a child outside of your union, then what does that mean? Well, your child now has no rights. So that's a penalty for having a child outside of a union. So therefore, it forces more monogamy. So there's lots of rules. We go down the list. There's lots of rules that then end up forcing and creating the monogamous nuclear family. That's just 1,000, 1,500, right? So it's not that long ago if you look at us as human beings.
Yeah. And I too, like, I'm obsessed, not on, with a slightly different lens. I'm obsessed with it from thinking about the mother's experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens now in these manufactured nuclear families is that typically, not always, you know, the mother will be left with a baby on a street where she probably doesn't know anyone, on her own, sometimes from 9 till 7, because her partner, if she's got one, is out of work. That is completely unnatural. There's unbelievable studies yep. on alloparents, which
yes.
actually shows that when we were in those clans of 50s, the children benefited so much from having, that's how it should be. And
should.
Our physiology and our biology has not changed.
Right.
And so it's completely unnatural. And the mother's coming to me saying, I can't cope. I'm not cut out for this. I feel depressed. And I feel so passionately saying, it's not you.
Yeah, it's not.
It's unnatural.
It is unnatural. And even to extend this, I like where we're going on this. Even to extend this, yeah, I'm gonna get comfortable here. Hold on for a second. It's disproportionately happening in the West.
Yes.
Right? Because, you know, I feel like there's always been this battle, right? You have individualism, you have collectivism, right? East versus West. And we thought in the West, we've always been taught and trained, well, we've got it right. They're the ones who got it wrong. It's about being an individual. You know, it is about making your own and moving from the United States to the UK. You know, you make that move. And my wife and I land here, we love it, but our entire support system is in the United States. And think about how much of a psychological impact that makes on the family. And then to your point about, you know, we're talking about there's not equity in the household. You know, the early stages, I am out working. My wife is homeschooling our kids, she holding it down. With no support, no external support, no cousins or aunts or uncles that we could drop, none of that. We went wrong in the West thinking that this was the right way to go. Collectivism from a family standpoint is 1,000% the right direction.
It's so interesting you talk about that experience, because I was almost picturing Jill, you know, because I had the same experience. It's like, and then you say to someone, you know, I'm not coping with this. And often the message is, you need to, you know, there's something wrong with you.
There's something wrong with you.
Or you need to do some more self-care. Or have you tried?
Right.
It drives me bananas.
Yeah.
Because it's like, no, there's no amount of bubble baths and spa days that is going to fix a woman who has got too much load.
Yeah.
She's holding the emotions of too many people without enough support herself.
Right. And then on top of it, there's a lot of people saying, oh, you're spoiled. Oh, look at you. Oh, you're privileged. Look at that. Look at that. You, at least you could stay home. You know, it's one of those.
It's the at least.
Yeah. It is ridiculous. But at the same time, we have to understand, and this is what I love about this conversation, is that it's not us. It's this system. Like, we've been placed in this very screwy system, and we need to understand that. That allows for the self-compassion that you're talking about. And then that understanding allows for us to work on interventions or new strategies to get around it.
Is that why you're so passionate about talking about couples prioritizing themselves and their relationship over, at times, you know, their parenting and their children?
Oh, absolutely. I think the most quote unquote hate that I've ever received in my...
I did see.
Oh yeah, you saw it.
I saw it.
You saw it.
I mean, you went on national TV. You went on Lorraine. And so, people don't get nuance on Lorraine.
No, it was pretty much, all right, Paul hates kids.
That was one headline I saw.
Yeah. Paul hates kids. Paul has announced, Paul Brunson has announced that he prioritizes his wife above his kids. And, you know, and my boys were like, but he does. He does. That's what he does. You know, and but, you know, you got to unpack the nuance of it and realize that we are, and I stand by it, is we are the foundation for our children as parents. And the stronger the foundation, the stronger the children, right? The weaker the foundation, the weaker the children. And if we, so therefore, to me, it means that you invest everything you can into the strength of that foundation so that you can then lift the children up. And that's, in essence, you know, what I was trying to argue.
Yeah. And I think, yeah. And when our kids need us, we're there too.
Yeah,
it's not
yeah.
an either,
it's not either or.
Or.
It's not either or.
What is this black and white world that we live in? But what does that practically look like for you and Jill?
You know, I'll give exact examples. I think I keep going back to last night. Last night, what it means is bedtime for our boys is 8:30. So I have a 9-year-old, a 13-year-old. 8:30 is bedtime for the 9. The 13-year-old, his is like 9. right?
Let him feel a bit more grown up.
Exactly. He's like, I'm grown up. So he thinks within the 30 minutes between 8:30 and 9, it's going to be, all right, we're going to hang out. It's hangout time. And I was like, nope, Kingston, it's date night. Your mom and I are having a date. So it's not hangout time because we're having a date. That's it in practical terms. You know, it is the prioritization of the time and the effort into the relationship. And I love how like Esther Perel always talks about this, and I think it's beautiful. It's like, you were here, your partner is here. And so you oftentimes think, okay, well, I'm working on myself. Yeah, I did that for my partner, but what are you doing for the relationship? That's the question. And so that's a small example of, I think, it in practice.
Have you ever found it hard to prioritize you and Jill?
Oh, yeah. I mean, with juggling, you know, life and, the prioritization is hardest when there's immense stress.
Yeah.
In a relationship for whatever reason. So, I mean, within the last few years, my sister-in-law, so Jill's sister, passed away. Mm. And there was, she was sick leading up to her passing. You know, it becomes very hard to prioritize the relationship. It's easy to prioritize your partner in that situation. But then to say, okay, we still need to prioritize our relationship. And so absolutely, you know, there are times where it's hard. And then you think about how we live in this chronic stress now. We're more stressed than ever before. All the research shows it. We're stressed because of on the tube, on the bus, this person do this, this person at work, this person this. So we live under chronic stress. And living under chronic stress is highly, highly dangerous. Hans Selye is the godfather of stress, right? He was the first person to associate stress with physical ailments. Hmm. So before him, this is early 1900s, before him, everyone thought, okay, you get sick. You know, you have an autoimmune disease. It's just because of the autoimmune disease. It's not because of the chronic stress, which, by the way, women, 75 to 80% of autoimmune disease, women, yeah. Right? So you think, okay, stress is incredibly dangerous for the body. And what Hans Selye would say is that, okay, you've got, when stress happens, there's alarm. Then there's a response to the alarm. That's the kind of the fight or flight. Like, I'm going to run towards it or run against it. And then there is the exhaustion from the alarm and the response. Mm-hmm. But if you're under chronic response, you're under that cycle all the time. So if you're under that cycle, your body, there's wear and tear, and that's where the ailments and autoimmune. And, you know, I was looking at the top five reasons for death around the world: cardiac illness, respiratory illness, stroke, diabetes, cancer. All five are either directly driven by stress, exacerbated by stress, or we have an inability to fight as a result of stress. So stress, I mean, like, so like we are all under attack by this terrible enemy called stress. And so, you know, you need to have partnership in order to help to regulate all that. But I have no idea where I was going with that. But stress is terrible.
Well, we were talking about how hard it can be to prioritize the relationship. And I was really struck when you said exhaustion from all the stress, right? Because sometimes my husband will say to me, do you want to go out Thursday night? And my first thought will be like, I'm too tired. Like, I just need to... But then, you know, then I'll be like, actually, no, I've got to prioritize this relationship. Yeah. But I think that absolutely plays into it, particularly with young kids. Like, it is an assault on the nervous system, as you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so hard to choose to prioritize that relationship when we're all exhausted.
Yeah.
But what I'm really hearing from you, and it really struck me about that foundation, that is how we raise our kids up. We have to keep investing in that.
Yes. And then the foundation also helps with the regulation of the stress, right? So, you know, the Gabor Mates of the world, and Dr. Stephen Porges, polyvagal theory.
Yeah.
He is, I think he paints out the picture most eloquently, where he talks about how when we are under threat, so we are under stress, how it's most important to have another nervous system to help to regulate us.
Yeah, okay, regulation.
And yes. And another nervous system could be your dog, but the best is to have another human being. And what's even better to have another human being who's just platonic is to have another human being that you have a high level of emotional intimacy with.
I think you're right, Paul. I think, you know, that stress, I was so touched by what you were saying about that stress collapse and just the exhaustion that can bring. And then, you know, having to prioritize our relationships with young kids, it's so hard. But what I really took from this is just that foundation. And that is how we raise that, you know, that's how we support our kids to be into the people that they want to be, is investing in that foundation, even when it's really hard.
Even when it's really hard. But investing in the foundation not only gets you returns from the children, but returns in your relationship. You know, it is, you know what it's like, investing in the foundation. It's like a good stock with dividends. You know what I mean? You get the appreciation of the stock, and then you also get the dividends that come from it. So that's exactly it. And whenever you can see an adult that has very strong behaviors, secure attachment, high self-esteem, they will attribute that to how they were raised. So there you go right there.
100%. Yeah. And I can see that in my friends. You can almost tell when you meet someone.
Yeah.
You can almost tell,
you know,
what type of parents they had.
Yes. Yes.
I've loved this chat.
This has been so good.
So good.
Yeah, this is really good. You're pretty good at what you do.
Oh, thanks. I'll take that. Yeah. So I always ask the same question at the end.
Okay.
Which is, if you could give just one gift to all the mothers in the world, what would that one gift be and why?
Supreme well-being. The highest of high well-being. Well-being off the charts, right? That's exactly what it would be, because I believe that our well-being and our personal satisfaction is what allows us to be satisfied with life. It's what allows us to attract great partners. It's what allows us to identify the bad partners. It's what allows us to identify the good or the bad friends. Well-being is everything. So that's what I would give.
Thank you.
You're welcome.